You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Current Blue Podcast post-match reaction. I'm your host, Dan Rowlinson, and I'm joined here by Matt Lynch. Matt, how are you, pal?
I'm all good, yeah. I feel a little bit relieved after the end of that climatic ending, but yeah, all good.
Yeah, good. We're a couple of minutes later than scheduled because, Matt, you've got a new microphone, and before we started, you had it on, like, I don't know whether it was a setting or what, but it sounded like you were in the middle of a massive cathedral. Is that a click of a button that fixed that for you?
Well, there's about five different buttons on it, and as I must admit, shamefully, as somebody that's got so much history in audio, I don't know what to do, so here we are.
But at some point throughout this podcast, just switch that setting back to cathedral mode, and let's just have a little bit of chat in that as well. Yeah, absolutely bizarre, but as bizarre as the last 10 minutes or so of that game was, loads to talk about from throughout the game, our defending at set pieces, some of the team selection, little bits and pieces as well. But my head, as much as I've seen the game, is very much dominated by the last 10 minutes of that injury time and the VAR and the ruling out of that goal. So weirdly, we're going to start at the very end. Do you feel like we've got away with one there, or are you happy that that was the correct decision by the officials?
I think it was the correct decision from the start, but I think you could see it quite early on. And I think that if anything, they were looking for something else that wasn't there. I'd say I think there's a few sort of bits that you can break down in that incident that you can look at and go, okay, that's not how it should be in terms of the direction of the ball, in terms of travel. And I think it becomes pretty quickly as soon as you spot the ball heading in a different direction. I think it's Konsa that clears it and then sort of ricochets around a bit and then suddenly goes the other way. When obviously Suchek's handled it, but then the suggestion Bowen's handled it as well. But yeah, my head is a bit scrambled by it. I wasn't sure what I was looking for by the end. I just clocked that there was a definite arm movement from Suchek towards the ball, and the ball's end up in the back of the net, and there we are. But I, to a degree, still got away with it, yes, but I'm glad that the right outcome's out in the end, but it's just ridiculous how long that's taken. I'm not sure if it was as bad as the Wolves Coventry one yesterday in terms of time, but it was pretty bad.
Yeah, it seemed like it went on for a long time. We'll talk about the process in a second. I felt like when they were talking, well, I don't know who my commentary team was. I should have written their names down because I'll be referring to them again later. But they were talking about it's Bowen, it's hit his arm, it's Bowen. And I was thinking, the replays that I'm looking at, I'm seeing Suchek, it's kind of blocked by the post a little bit, and it's very, very minor, to be fair. There's a slight kind of arm as if he's pushing the ball, and you can see the ball deviate very slightly. So, you know, there was the one earlier in the game that's hit his arm, and it's kind of like, oh, not really much you could do about that. But that one, there's a bit of a movement. It's one of those, isn't it? Any Villa fan watching this will go, yeah, who cares? We got away with one. It was the right decision, etc. If you're a West Ham fan, you'd be fuming with that. And I think if it was a Villa, if it had gone against Villa, you'd be going, come on, there's nothing in that. Surely you don't give handball for that. So, yes, there's part of my brain that says we should have that viewpoint as well, that, oh, yeah, maybe that shouldn't be the law, first of all. Maybe it shouldn't be so minor and take that long to look at. But the biased Villa fan in me says, yes, of course, absolutely, right decision. Thank you, referee. Thank you, Jared Gillett. Thank you, VAR team. But, yeah, it should not take as long as it does, should it?
No, I think that's the principle with it all, is that You look at all these decisions and how long they take. They were looking over the same footage time and time again. And to be honest, as you say, the post was in the way for most of that footage. The first angle they showed of that incident was the clearest one of the lot. Because to be fair, I think if anything, the first angle they showed, which was from sort of like the left-hand side of the pitch looking across, it was obvious that seemingly Bowen had touched it that way as well. And you could see Suchek's movement. But obviously the Suchek one from behind the net in as such is what they've played over and over again. But it amazes me in the same breath as that we're in the Premier League with multi-million pounds worth of camera equipment on these matches, yet they're still struggling in 8-bit by the end to try and digest whether Suchek has touched the ball. It's beyond the realms of possibility that surely they've got better camera equipment available to them. And they didn't even, I don't know if they've got the availability to, but the camera that's directly inside the goal didn't even think of using that one seemingly, or whether it was not clear enough. But to me, that's the prime angle to be able to see anything in that incident. But who are we to judge in that one? I'm sure the PGML know what they're doing.
Yeah. Just quickly as well, I actually think, and maybe this is my Villa bias here, I actually think Suchek on Konsa is a foul anyway. Regardless of the handball, I think he's dragged Konsa down anyway. So if it's not given for handball, I think it should have been given as a free kick. But anyway, it doesn't matter. It's gone Villa's way, whether you agree with the rules or not. That is what it is. Just on the process again, and the commentary team that I was listening to, and I think it'll be the kind of from the World feed, at all, like the Premier League, Sky Sports branding and stuff on the thing that I was consuming the game on. And so that commentary will probably be available elsewhere anyway. But they were talking about how they knew it was going to be ruled out because the commentary team have it, don't they? They have the VAR stuff it's not being broadcast, but the commentators can see it. Gary Neville often refers to it when he's doing a game that he's kind of, they're drawing the lines now, but we can't see it as the audience. And they said before Gillett had even gone over to look at it, West Ham fans aren't going to like this one. You just wait to hear what the boos will be like when they announce that this has been ruled out. And then the referee goes to go and look at it and they go, oh, the referee's going to look at it. And I'm thinking, well, they already know that this is ruled out. They're in the process of like, why is he going to look at it if they've already kind of informed the decision that it's handball or whatever. But yeah, the fact that, again, it takes as long as it does. The commentators who are broadcasting it, they know. But as fans in the stadium have no idea. Fans watching it don't really have any idea because we're not being broadcast what the commentary can see. And then the referee still has to go and have a look at it. And the commentators are going, oh, well, I quite like that actually, because it's his decision and he's got to go and look at it. And he watched it once and went, yeah. So, what was the point of that? It seems a bizarre process all round. And you'd think, you know, 3-4 years into VAR, whatever we are now, it would be more refined than it is. And it still feels a little bit like we're kind of playing it, you know, making it up as we go along.
Yeah, I think that the key thing there, as you say, is there's no definition to the process, as in what's the protocol. And
no kind of like standardisation.
Yeah, no, exactly that. And I think if you look at it, this incident is bound to be on Howard Webb's and Michael Owen's little programme that goes on Sky every couple of
weeks. Well, actually, Michael, the referee's done the right thing there, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And the funny thing is we'll hear all the audio and they'll cut out the 5 minutes of waffle that's gone on in the meantime to get to the point of the decision and probably conclude the same anyway. But I don't get how we can have this TV program that's broadcast every 2 weeks where we can hear all the referees' audio and we can hear XYZ from Howard Webb, but we can't hear the key bits of audio. I think it clears up so much for the fans that are watching at home and even the spectators in the stadium. You hear it used in rugby. I mean, the Six Nations finished. Was it today or yesterday, whenever it finished, the rugby, you hear the referees the whole time and you hear that over the tannoy, let alone if you're sat there at home. So you're kept in the loop. And if we're at this stage now where we're going to be taking 4 or 5 minutes to make a decision, it's only common sense that they should be keeping the fans in the loop, because Gianni Infantino this week has come out and said that fans love it, the drama of it. I'm sat there going, do we love the idea of being sat in our seats for 4 or 5 minutes, none the wiser what's going on? The answer to that is, well, no. So, but it says a lot about where things are heading at the moment.
No, I absolutely do not love it. That last 10 minutes or so of that game was stress-inducing. It was not an enjoyable thing. Again, I'm watching it and I avoid my phone as much as possible. And I had to respond to a message and it popped up on my notifications. I should have had it on, you know, airplane mode or whatever. Goal, West Ham. I was like, oh, I was angry. And then I get to see it, you know, a couple of minutes later. And all the, you know, all the fanfare that comes with it being ruled out and whatever else. And it feels like a let off and it feels like a point gain, which, oh God, let me come back to that in a little bit. But the process of getting there, you know, it highlights some deficiencies, doesn't it? This game in Villa's defending of set pieces in particular. I think we seem susceptible from that when there's a side that's got physicality and good delivery. Luton threatened us from set pieces. West Ham have done it down a couple of occasions. That flags up a little bit of a concern. And yes, ultimately, we've gone on to draw the game, and that's okay. So I think it's a decent point. But there is something there that one of these weeks, we will come unstuck by a set piece and lose the game. And that will be a frustration, because we can feel like, well, that's something we know we're not good at. So we need to, that is something that needs to improve.
Yeah, I think it's become apparent throughout the season. I tried to find the exact number before coming on the amount of goals we conceded from set pieces, but it genuinely feels like every goal at the moment has come from a set piece scenario or close to. And I think today especially it showed the frailties. I don't think Martinez gets the best protection of goalkeepers in the league. And I mean that in terms of from the referees. And I think that's just because Martinez carries his own reputation in terms of the way he plays the game.
Yeah.
But in the same breath as that, he deserves protection from his own teammates, in the sense of actually players that are bundling there. Because every time Antonio was stood on the toes of Martinez, yet not one of our defenders has opted to go over there and support it. And in the end, it's led to a goal in the first half. And that's just poor, because we've already had a few set pieces before there where we were seeing what Antonio is going to do is stick on Martinez. And it's pretty clear that it's one of the fundamentals as to why Antonio was on the pitch today, is because he was going to cause disruption at set pieces. And that's exactly what he did with that first goal. And then again, we obviously got lucky with the what ended up being the disallowed goal, but that delivery from James Ward-Prowse was a peach, to be fair, equally. But in the same breath as that, our high line in that situation perhaps did catch us a bit cold. But it's just annoying that we see these scenarios run and run over and over again. And I've just realised I said about the Antonio goal, but again, that was another one was disallowed. But it's by the by. It's just poor defender when it comes to these set pieces, and we come unstuck week after week. And it feels like we're talking about it week after week as well. And I know from reading different bits and pieces and things, I understand that seemingly Austin McPhee doesn't have too much to say about defensive side of things, and you have to question why, considering we've got him in there to look at the attacking sense and trying to do things creatively. Well, surely you should be looking at how we should be defending the corners and set pieces a lot better as well.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
The first goal, the Antonio's goal was given, again, comes from a good delivery into the box, but again, not great defending. You've got three centre-halves on the pitch at that point, and none of them want to win it as much as Antonio does. And again, there's a slight kind of like classic Villa thing we can hold up here and go, classic Villa moment. Antonio not scored since August, so of course, almost scores two goals against Villa. That must happen to every club, but it feels like it happens to us all the time. If you're in a goal rut, play Aston Villa and you'll score. Not one for six, play Aston Villa and you'll win your first game in a dry spell. That's the kind of thing seems to happen quite a lot. Just back to the commentators for my last point. They were saying at the end as it went back into the studio as well, and I think it was Howard, no, not Howard Webb, another bald guy, Tim Howard, was in the studio. And they all were saying that the pundits and the commentary team were saying that it's points dropped for Villa in the race for top four. Spurs now only 3 points behind them. It's dropped points for Villa and opportunity missed. Opportunity missed, I agree with, because obviously Spurs lost yesterday. So if we'd have won today, we'd have opened up a bigger gap to fifth place. And that is a missed opportunity in that sense. But Spurs lost yesterday. We drew coming from behind. We held on at the end with a goal ruled out. That's a point gained. Not points lost, not points dropped. Yes, I get it that we didn't get three. We only got one. Points dropped in that sense. But the overall bigger picture is that's a point gained, isn't it, Matt?
You know, this term deserves to be submitted into football cliches to find out the true answer as to what it means. Because, to be honest, I couldn't tell you neither there which way around it should be. To me, it is a point gained on the basis we've come from behind as point one. So, and in the same sort of ilk as that, I suppose, that is it points lost just because we were so dominant in the second half? And to be honest, we did have
plenty of chances in the second half, were we?
No, exactly. But here we are. What's the definition of points gained and point lost in the terms of that context?
Yeah, it's a point gained for me. Yes, Spurs lost yesterday. We come from behind to get a point. That's a point gained. Absolutely is. And also, we spoke pretty much about not having a great record against West Ham, particularly away. We've not won away at West Ham since Gabby scored the winner off the bench in 2011 at the Upton Park. Totally different team, totally different stadium. A decent point, that is, for me, away at West Ham. Absolutely. Like, that's a game we look at in this end of season run and go, that's not easy. That's pretty difficult, West Ham. Still got something to play for, to get into Europe. Could possibly leapfrog Man United and get into the Europa League. Like, that's, you know, West Ham have got absolutely something to play for and have the fight. And there's a lot of talk about David Moyes and the style of football and whatever else. But they gave us a good game. And for us to get out of London with a point is absolutely a great point, in my opinion. Yes, I'd love to win every game, but it's not realistic, is it? If you're picking up points away from home and 3 points at Villa Park, that's going to stand you in good stead over the course of the season.
Yeah, I think you've summed it up perfectly. And I think the thing to remember here is that West Ham are on a run where they've lost one of their last 8 at home, and that was when Arsenal thumped them. But I think, to be honest, if you came across Arsenal at the moment, they're going to thump anyone, bar anyone in the top 4 probably at the moment. And to be fair, if Villa played Arsenal, I mean, there's a chance we could get thumped as well. But I think that the West Ham form at home is so good, and especially when we're so bad against West Ham, typically, as you say, dating back to 2011, then it's absolutely a point gained, and it's going to be a valuable one come the end of the season. You know, that West Ham have got things to fight for as well. I think they're as close to Man United as anyone else in terms of that hunt to keep their European hopes alive. And obviously, they're still in European football as well. So there's no skin of fan those to get a point. You know, I think that if you look at their midfield on paper today as well, and how they performed, they had such a much stronger sort of setup than us just because of us losing McGinn and obviously Kamara missing as well. And you look at the way that Paqueta and Edison Alvarez absolutely controlled the midfield in the first half in particular. They were so good and so composed that I was worried they'd have the run of the land in the second half when Tielemans tends to tire a bit. But obviously that didn't really play out as that because we were much better in the second half. But yeah, it's absolutely a point gained, and it's one that we'll look back on in the end of the season and go, yeah, that's worthy of being a good solid point for us. And, you know, we've got Wolves at home, is it, coming up next in terms of the international break, followed by Brentford. There's 2 games at home where you've got to be looking at going 6 points, and suddenly we're in a very strong position with what would be about 7 games to play at that point. So, yeah, look, it's a point gained.
Yeah, definitely. Let's talk about Zaniolo then. He's the one that has gained us the point as Sheffield United as well. Comes off the bench to score the goal and finally get past the West Ham goalkeeper, whose name I've forgotten, who was, you know, who had a good game, to be fair. West Ham, they're a good side. They gave us a decent game. I was kind of, I don't know, like, say I was impressed with them as if I didn't know what they would be, but Villa have more than enough quality to beat West Ham if everyone's on form. And it's like this weird scenario where it's like the best 11 versus best 11. Villa should beat West Ham because the quality is more. But West Ham were good, man. I was impressed to a certain degree. So for Zaniolo to be one to break the deadlock is probably not the player you would expect to have the quality to beat them in the end or to get something out of it. So he comes off the bench. There's a comment from Sal who says, "What's up with Zaniolo, lol?" I'm going to flash this up because I don't know, like, as if this is my wording. "What's up with Zaniolo, lol? Blood shushed his own fans," which he said probably differently to how I said it. I mean, he's the thumbnail for this podcast as well. And when I first scored it, I was like, he definitely shushed. And I was like, we're attacking the Villa fans, aren't we? So I don't know what the politics is there, whether Zaniolo mistook the claret and blue in the away end for the home end, possibly, maybe, who knows. But yeah, just a strange one. If he was shushing the Villa fans or whatever it was, who knows? But he's a bit of an enigma still, isn't he, Zaniolo? I'm going to open this up to a wider point rather than just about the goal today, because it's a decent move. He toe pokes it in. Happy days. It gets the point. Not really much more to say on that. But his performance, he does a couple of silly things. He always gets a yellow card when he comes on. He throws the ball away, which, taking away any kind of Villa bias, that's a yellow card. He's already been booked. He should have been sent off. Mm. If you're playing by the rules, and again, we talk about referee consistency. If you've been booked and then you do something as silly as throwing the ball away, which we know is a bookable offence, that was silly. And it's that kind of side of Zaniolo's game that's like, yes, he's got the goal and he's got us the point, and that's good, and there's something there, something about him. But he's also got this strange side of his game where he gets involved in things that he doesn't need to and just is a little bit naive, maybe.
Yeah, I look at it and I think he's just a live wire. And I think this is like a lazy point to make, but you look at the two clubs he's played at before Villa and you associate both of them being very fiery teams in Rome and Galatasaray. You combine that with somebody like him who is a hothead anyway, and suddenly you've got the player that it is. And you're looking in terms of the managers he's been under as well, people like Jose Mourinho. You probably need somebody like United to probably steer him a bit more. And I know he's obviously had a lot to deal with as well in the last 12 months of everything that kicked off in the summer. So perhaps he's misunderstood, but I think the famous term with that one is Mario Balotelli was misunderstood. And you look at him, he was an enigma to say the least. So there's definite parallels between those two, by the way. But the wider point about him is that he's obviously on loan for us, whether he stays another season. I don't think it's going to happen, but he's came up with two big goals for us now. Where was the other goal? He came off the bench and scored an equaliser for us. Yeah. So he's scored two vital goals for us that could turn out to be two vital points. And you look at the end of the season and you look at what he's come in for. And yeah, you might not have turned up for X amount of time and got booked every 85 minutes as I worked out before we came on. But he scored two really important goals so far, and there's a huge part for him to play come the end of the season. And, you know, the more of these players he's going to need to be called on if we are going to sustain where we're at the moment and keep that top four spot. So there's more to come from him. And I think him getting called up to Italy was a strange move, but hopefully he can play some more football then and he comes back in form in the sense of actually just playing some football in the next coming weeks as well.
Yeah, Mr. D, I'll be called up for France as well, hasn't he? And he's looked good in the last couple of games. Hopefully that revitalises him a little bit and he can perform at his international side as well. Just another point for the Football Clichés podcast. I've shouted these out in a couple of weeks if they need a shout out. Far bigger podcast than us. The way you said then about he scored two vital goals and got us two vital points in Sheffield United and today. And if you know we look at the end of the season and say those are the 2 points that got us into the top four, it's like, why is it not any of the other 60-odd points that the 30 that Ollie Watkins has won us through his goals or whatever? Do you know what I mean? It's a strange phrase, isn't it, to just pick out two goals? But yeah, I know what you mean. Moreno, let's talk about him a little bit. That is a noise that probably sums him up a little bit, isn't it? If this wasn't live, I'd loop that a few times. It'd be funny. Maybe for the audio version, I'll do it. Why not? There we go. I'll put it in there. When Moreno signed, we were kind of like, oh, do we need a left back? We've got Luca Dean. He's pretty good, isn't he? And Moreno's kind of transformational is the word that we used last January. He kind of changed the way we play down the left-hand side, linked up with Jacob Ramsey well, yada, yada, yada. We've done that before. Since injury, he's not quite been the same player this season, has he? He's still got something about him. He's still got decent pace, still gets to the byline and can put a good ball back across the box. But there's something there that is not quite what we had last season, and there's a stage where Luca Dean may go out to move to Saudi Arabia and all these different things when you know off the wage bill. Luca Dean is probably the player I'll be starting now over Moreno.
Yeah, I think Moreno's got cashiitis, which is looking to turn back. He gets to the byline and turns back on himself.
That's and it's a real shame. His last couple of games, by the way. He's very good at the end of the
day. He's been very good today. And I obviously probably come to that. But in terms of Moreno, for me, it's a strange one because he is the shadow of him for himself. I don't know. It's whether he's scared to go into a 50-50 that might see him sort of aggravate what happened before, or whether he's just not got the confidence. I don't know, but he's just not the same. And when someone like Dean has been performing so well, I think Luke is very unfortunate to have missed out today. But then in the same breath, Luke has not been sort of adverse to injuries in the past either as well. So perhaps it is a bit of that as well, where Emery's mindful as well. But as well, we've got a two-week gap now before we play Wolves with the international break, if you want to call it that. So there's plenty of time for something was to go wrong. But I think that, yeah, on that one, I think just Emery's trying to appease both of them as it stands. And it's quite clear he's not sure which is the best option. But for me, as it stands, I'd argue outside of Watkins, Douglas, I mean, there's so many good players for us this season. But in terms of defenders, Luca Dean's been our best defender all season so far.
There's something I wanted to bring up on the preview show that I forgot to, and I'm not going to do it in detail now because I don't have it in front of me. Somebody had compiled a list for Neil, actually, from the For the Love of Paul McGrath podcast, and I chimed in on Twitter and said, can I actually nick this for ours? And then I forgot to do it anyway. But I got minutes played across the last six games, I think it was, for West Ham and for Villa, because obviously we both had the same European commitments, the Thursday midweeks and then the Premier League action. And it had got like a core group, I think it was something like 450 minutes were available over the course of those six or seven games. And there was, I think there was five or six starting West Ham players who had played all 450, and not a single one of Villa players had played the full 450. I think it was Douglas Luiz was very close with like 440 or something like that. But the spread across the rest of the Villa players was quite even in terms of like 200 here, 300 there, which kind of makes the point that we've rotated maybe better than West Ham have, which is a strange point to make after the game, but that we've got this unit who've kind of dealt well with the European campaign, I guess, and the problems that can sometimes have. That yes, we can talk about who's better, Dean or Moreno. As much as Moreno's not been great, we still have to rely on these players to come in and play a part. We can't just flog the same 11 week in, week out. Someone like Zaniolo, who the last podcast I think we did was like, if Zaniolo is the answer, what is the question? We were like, well, we don't know what the question is. Today, it's who's going to get the equalising goal against West Ham? Nicolò Zaniolo is the answer. So sometimes we are kind of maybe quick to write off certain players. I think, I'm not sure where he fits in now. Or what's Bailey's role? What's Diaby's role? You know, he's been on the bench a lot. How will he be feeling about that? And he comes in and again, he's looked decent and maybe he's getting into some kind of form for the back, you know, 7, 8, 9 games of the season, which is a good time to hit some kind of form. So a bigger kind of overarching point that we've got a squad there and we've got a decent squad despite being ravaged by injury, that we are going to have to rely on players in different positions. Tielemans playing in the central midfield slot rather than out on the left, things like that, where we're going to have to kind of cobble together a squad. And that if we can still come away with a point at a tricky West Ham away ground, I think that's a sign of like we're being managed correctly. As much as maybe we may disagree with some of Unai Emery's selections, which we'll touch on in a sec, overall, we're kind of always heading in the right direction, even if it feels kind of incrementally.
Yeah, absolutely. I always look back and go, I hate the whole idea of perspective. Oh, look where we were 18 months ago. Look where we were 2 years ago. I can look where I was 2 years ago and think, oh, wow. But the thing with that is that we have got a different bite and metal about us where I'm actually not too concerned when we go one down. I'm very concerned when we go two down because I know we ship goals at that point. But at 1-0 down, I'm never too concerned with us. And I think that's a testament to the squad of players that we've got in terms of depth and the options that we've got. And I'm sure we'll have to come into the subs in terms of that 11, starting 11 in a minute. But I think that the key part today was the fact that, you know, I knew when to make those subs today and they paid off. And that comes down to managing minutes. As you say, that comes down to the fact that these guys haven't been sort of busting it every week for 90 minutes. They've had that bit of rest time in between and he's trying to manage those minutes better, which comes in when you've got something like Diaby that you're able to bring off the bench. I mean, in terms of actual quality, if we're being honest at the moment on the Villa bench, it's probably few and far between, realistically. Outside of obviously today bringing Diaby on and arguably Morgan Rogers also been on the bench previously, but you look at the actual quality to come off the bench today and you wouldn't have probably put Zaniolo in that category, all things considered. The only one you'd have put in that category would be Diaby. So to have that option on the bench is great. And that comes down to managing minutes, as you say, especially when we are in this position at the moment where injuries seem to be ravaging us like they have been. And I think that comes down to probably realistically why we started with the three centre-backs today. Or whether that was just something that you and I felt was probably best to combat what West Ham were going to bring, especially from their fullbacks. I don't know, but I think that we are managing it well as things stand anyway.
I will ask you another retrospective question, but not as far back as 18 months or 5 years. 90 minutes. Did we make the right starting 11 choices? Do you think Emery got it right from the off?
The actual Duran experiment was great. I thought that it was a good show, but the two problems with it was our two fullbacks, I think, to be honest, if we're honest. I don't think we see enough of Konsa. I can see why Emery likes him at right back, but we don't see enough of Konsa getting forwards and actually getting balls into the box, which is something that Matty Cash, to his credit, does very well. And on the same breath as that, we didn't see much from Moreno on the other side doing the same. So it did leave Duran and Watkins a bit high and dry at times and lacking. So I don't think it was a bad selection. I just think that he's trying to tweak things and I totally get it, but I think the implementation was perhaps just a little bit off just because of the options in terms of fullbacks and where we're headed from there. I think the right fullbacks, that system works, but without the fullback options to start the game like we did today, then you end up in the position where you're scrambling at half time looking to make those subs as we did with bringing off Lenglet and bringing on Cash.
Yeah, we've spoken a few times about Emery's substitutions when it's not quite going well, and you know, I always say, who are we to question, you know, Emery? But there's times where you think, come on, like, it's time to make a sub now. Like, why wait till the 65th, 70th minute before you change it when you can see that it's not working? Jack in the comments and Jay both say that Emery made subs at the right time and doing man management brilliantly in terms of integrating players into the side and whatnot. The subs at half time was something that I was glad to see. It clearly wasn't quite working in the first half, and to be kind of proactive and almost brave, I suppose, for want of a better word, to make the changes then rather than just go, oh, have another 15 minutes, see if you can work it out amongst yourselves. So, no, we need to make changes now is a sign of a manager who knows what he's doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, to be fair, though, the subs came at the right time, as you say today. And I think, if anything, I think I'd probably have expected the Moreno-Didney substitution before the Cash-Lenglet one. But
yeah,
there's something to be said for changing too much too soon as well. And as for Duran, that's obviously his first start this season. So you'd always expect he's not going to last the full 90. But I thought he put himself about quite well, to be honest. It was as chaotic as we expect from him, but the substitutions were equally as we'd sort of expect in terms of format, as if it was Trezeguet and El Ghazi back in the day.
Good memories. Yeah, Cash was great. I thought he played really well. He played well against Ajax as well. That block at the very end of the game. Again, we'll talk about, you know, when we finish in the top four and it's Zaniolo's goal, it's Cash's block that saved us the point today, that got us into the top four. He celebrated, didn't he? Like, he scored a goal, like a fist bump, and after the move had broke down, he was celebrating it again. Fair play to him. It was a great block. Probably a contender for man of the match, which is bizarre to only play half a game. I thought he was that impactful to allow us to be more forward-thinking on the right-hand side. Just a word quickly to end the show, because we've done half an hour, about John McGinn. Callum says, massively miss McGinn's energy and drive with the ball. And Kieran asks, do you think we'll struggle without McGinn against Wolves and Man City? I think the quick answer to that is yes, and that is something we'll talk about on our next podcast in more detail. However, from the result perspective, we kind of haven't missed McGinn, because I do think a point away at West Ham is probably about par. I still think that's a decent result. If McGinn was playing, does that mean we'd have won? Not necessarily. I still think a point would have been a good result with him inside or without him. But in terms of how we play and Tielemans having to play centrally, of course we miss what McGinn brings to the side. And the sooner he's back, maybe re-energised by having a bit of a break, the better.
Yeah, I think you said that point exactly as I was going to come onto it, is the fact that, if anything, McGinn would be overworked in the coming weeks if it wasn't for this break for him, this enforced break. So, if anything, I hope we see a more reinvigorated John McGinn, the McGinn that we saw pre-Christmas, because, to be honest, post-Christmas has not been half as good as he was pre. And I think that's just down to the fact that he's having to do a lot of workload in that midfield at the moment, just by virtue of the fact that we have struggled for options. Obviously, JJ coming in and out of the team in terms of injuries, losing Kamara, big blow. With Wendy obviously was sitting into that midfield sort of section as well in the past as well. So he's had a heavy workload, to be fair to him. So I know he'll obviously play for Scotland in their coming up internationals, but then he's still got a couple of weeks just to obviously rest and recuperate and then give it a big slog for the last five.
Yeah, that's a nice way to end the show, I think. Matt, thank you very much for joining me this Sunday afternoon to talk about West Ham 1, Aston Villa 1. As I keep saying, I think that is a decent point, a decent result. We will be recording our Monday show tomorrow, on Monday, of course. I believe it's myself, Matt and John in the studio for the first time. And the first time we've recorded a podcast as a three since November 17th, when we did Building the Ultimate Aston Villa Football, I believe, in an international break. So it's been a long time since we've all been together as a three. It's a Q&A episode, so if you want to get involved with that and ask one of the lads a question, you can scroll down to the YouTube comments and get involved with that show. I will also put a tweet out after this as well, so if you would rather do it on Twitter, you can contact me on there, at Dan Rowlandson. That's all for this one. Matt, thanks very much for your time. Thanks everyone for watching or listening, and we'll see you again tomorrow, although I will say we're recording it tomorrow, but it might come out Tuesday. Bear that in mind. Thanks everyone, we'll see you then.